Secure safety harness now. Docking with RPG X-Ray commencing in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to RPG X-Ray, the podcast that looks inside what makes RPGs tick. If you're a role-playing gamer that wants to think about the hidden systems inside the games we love to play, join us for a regular discussion of the theory and practice of tabletop role-playing. As a reminder, before we get rolling, please stay in touch with us and send in your own thoughts and questions. We're reachable via links on our website, rpgxray.com, or via our email, contact@rpgxray.com. In this episode, we talk fiction. Specifically, how does fiction and mechanics interact in role-playing games? This is a broad topic, and there's a ton of ground to cover, from clocks to meta currencies to resolution systems. We're diving in deep, but hopefully bringing it back to how these concepts can be applied at your very own table. Joining the X-Ray team today are myself, Jason Beaumont, Eric Saltwell, and Ethan Schoonover. As always, before jumping into the main course, we like to start things off with an amuse-bouche we call Appendix X.
So in Appendix X, we do a little summary of all the media that we're consuming currently with a particular eye toward how it could be applied to gaming. Eric, you want to start us off? What are you reading? What are you watching? Listening to?
Yeah. The most interesting, I think, that I'm consuming from a gaming perspective is that I'm watching The Matrix with the screen off. So...
by the way, this is a very Saltwell thing to do, people. You don't see our faces, but we're all just like, uh-huh, yeah, okay.
So I've been listening to a podcast called 20,000 Hertz, which is from a sound production team, and they make a podcast about interesting sounds. It's kind of vaguely in the same ballpark as 99% Invisible for audio. And they did this thing about audio descriptions. And audio descriptions are tracks that are added to movies and TV, which are intended for people who are visually impaired. And so these are audio descriptions of what's going on in the scene. And as you can imagine, especially for action movies, these are professionals who have to provide the tone and the sense of what's going on. And for action movies, they have to really get in and describe what's going on in the action. But they also have to keep pace with a movie that's, you know, just throwing punches and not talking about it. And I feel like having heard some of this now, this is really a masterclass for descriptions if you're a game master running a game and want to provide descriptions of either the setting and the mood and the scene, or if there are action sequences. It's been really amazing.
Very cool.
I love that. What a great idea. I definitely want to try that. So is that just a audio, like, could you just select that as like one of the audio tracks on like a DVD or on like a stream?
Yep. So I've been doing it on Disney and on, I think, Netflix, maybe Vudu's, my streamers of choice. But yes, that's exactly right. It's just an audio stream and you just pick it like is if you're picking French instead of English.
Hmm. So my Appendix X is similar. It ties directly into yours. I'm reading a book that's called An Immense World. I think the subtitle is How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. And it's a book trying to get you into the headspace of how animals sense the world. And obviously you don't have the same kind of way of seeing as a muskrat, or the way of, you know, sensing vibrations in the water as an octopus. And the author does such an amazing job of trying to get you inside of the world, like the headspace of an animal, and the kind of descriptions that he has to use to just describe these different senses reminded me of exactly what you were just saying about describing kind of the scene on screen, where you really have to like really flex your descriptive language in like really creative and unique ways. And so that's something that I think, you know, I'm learning from to kind of get better at and bring in additional senses into my way of describing the scene to the players.
Yeah, I love that. We should talk about senses. We should have a whole episode on senses.
Yeah,
five senses. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Let's see. For myself, I am reading a book by David Gran, who wrote Killers of the Flower Moon, which I read a while ago, and it just was turned into a movie. I don't think that's out yet, actually.
That's the Martin Scorsese movie, right? Is that? Is that what it is?
Yes, question mark. It's with Leonardo DiCaprio. That's all I know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I just saw one trailer about it. So, but the book is called The Wager, and it is about during the 1700s when Britain was at war with Spain, there was a ship called The Wager that was converted from a merchant ship into a warship. And so far in the book, everything's fine, and the ship has not floundered or sunk, and nobody's been, cast away and marooned.
Maybe that's how it ends. Maybe that's how the movie ends.
I'm sure it'll be fine. So it is about mutiny and the ship sinking, and some trials and tribulations of the crew. So, but it's, I don't know, naval stuff. This is sort of like the dark side of Master and Commander.
Yeah,
I really, I've never sailed. I don't know. Like, I've been on boats plenty of times, I guess, but just ferries and things going out to islands, especially when I lived in Southeast Asia. But I've never really been on a true sailing vessel, and it fascinates me and terrifies me, and I just love it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Have you played?
Sorry.
I was gonna say, have you seen AMC's The Terror season one?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Totally, yeah. Reminds me of that.
Yep. I was thinking of the same thing. There, I don't know. There's a whole genre. It's something about, it's a great example of you have a fixed space that you can play within.
Yep.
Actually, that reminds me of a video game, right?
That's what I was about ready to ask.
The Obra Dinn.
Curse of the Obra Dinn. I was just about ready to ask if you played
The Return of the Obra Dinn.
Return of the Obra Dinn. That's right.
Pretty sure, I can't remember, but that game has a subtitle, which is something like a game of ships and insurance or something.
Right. It's way up your alley.
Oh, I love it. I love that game. Yeah. I sat down to play for 5 minutes, and then I got up 7 hours later.
Oh, wow.
And I had finished the game. I was just this is amazing.
Eric, are you familiar with the game at all?
I have heard of it, but I don't know anything about it.
So it's a murder mystery that's set on a boat in, I don't know what year, but the Age of Sail.
Yeah.
And
I would say late 1800s. Am I right about that?
That would make sense. And what happens is you're there after everything has gone wrong on this boat. And so you poke around and you can get inside the memories, and you use that to kind of piece together the mystery of what happened.
Yeah. You have a magic watch.
Yeah. Oh. Magic watch.
But,
that's right.
But you're basically like a claims adjuster.
Right. Oh, yeah. You're there to log all the insurance stuff. Right?
Throughout the game, you'll have these moments where you all of a sudden a journal appears and you log the insurance, the amount that you're going to end up paying out for this.
Which is very Lucas Pope, the creator. He did Papers, Please, where your job is to stamp passports. And,
oh, yeah. I remember that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So same person.
Great game, great themes. I don't know. I feel like all these things, stories on ships, stories in constrained spaces, they all, I don't know how to apply them in a role-playing game scenario, but it's so appealing to me. I really want to.
Well, they all have a really interesting fiction.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads me to our main topic. And Eric, since you pitched us on this topic, why don't you lead off with just what in the heck you meant when you said you want to contrast fiction as opposed to mechanics?
Sure. So first, let me talk a little bit about what I mean by the term fiction. So I feel like in the industry of role-playing games, when people talk about the fiction or fiction-first gaming, they're not so much talking about story or, is something true or not true. All they mean when they talk about the fiction is what is going on currently in the world of your game, right? So if you think about a role-playing game is taking place in a fictional world, that's what I mean by fiction. It's also often you'll hear me say a bunch the term fictional position, which is just what is going on at any moment of time in the game. And I think that when we play as gamers, we often play in two modes. And one is to think about our characters moving in the fiction and acting in the fiction. But then there's also another game, which is about thinking about the mechanics and what is my character doing in the mechanics. Mm. And coming at it, often we talk about great play. And I think that there are two ways, these are both ways you can think about great play. On the one hand, great play could mean mechanically great play, which is about picking the right things from your character sheet or optimizing your actions so that it has the best chance of success. On the other hand, I think that there is a sense of great play, which is about how does my character interact with the fictional position and take actions based on the fictional position. So I will give you an example, and then I want to also cover fiction first gaming, which is kind of a hot topic in gaming these days. So my example is Jason. We were very recently playing a one shot of the Star Trek role playing game. Is it by Mofidius?
I think so. Yep.
And in there, right, there was a moment where the players were outnumbered and being attacked. And one of the players said, oh, I'm going to challenge their big champion person to a one-on-one duel.
Right.
And that's not because the character has some ability that says you can challenge people to duels, or because they get an advantage when they're doing it. But it was a tactically good move from the perspective of the fiction, right? It meant that it wasn't 2-on-5 now. It was, you know, 1-on-1 or whatever is the case.
I think she noticed that her character had a knife and was a security officer on Starship. She was like, oh, that seems like somebody who would like duel, right? Like, yep. It was yep. very much like an in-character, in-fiction, I think, to put it in your framing, kind of moment. And you're right, there was no special skill, knife dueling.
Yep.
You know.
And so part of what I wanted to get at was to talk about, you know, I think there is a lot of people who talk in the gaming industry about the fiction being primal, the prime thing and the thing you talk about. And I wanted to ask, well, clearly role-playing games also have a big, like, it is a combination of fiction and mechanics. And how do we think about that? Do we think that one of these is more important or better than the other? What do we think is the way that these interact? What rules in games create really great interactions between the fictional position and the mechanics in a way that maybe makes it better than, you know, that it's like a Reese's peanut butter cup. It's better than the sum of its parts.
Let me just ask for, I want to contrast and clarify a little bit. There's so many terms related to this that get thrown around. So when I hear the term story game, I think a game that's mostly about fiction, mostly narrative.
Yep.
Is that how you read that term, story game?
So I definitely feel like story games are games where the rules as written, the text of the rules, is very much about the fiction and it is very, like, let's say, uncrunchy and very much, I actually think it's story as opposed to game, right? Which is that the goal of story games are very often not to succeed, or to the extent that you're overcoming a challenge. Like, if you think of a game as overcoming unnecessarily challenges for fun, then the challenge is coming up with the story. Yeah. In other words, you, the human player, have this challenge in mind, but the character itself is not trying to overcome any specific challenge. That's not the goal of great play in story games. I don't know. Jason, what do you think?
I feel like in the story games I've played, I'm thinking kind of mainly Gumshoe kind of style of games, right?
Oh, that's interesting. You call Gumshoe a story game.
Oh, would you not call it that?
Wow. No, that's not what I was thinking at all.
Oh, okay.
No, this is good.
Please.
This is good.
I want
you to continue now.
Okay. Well,
continue to dig a hole for yourself, my friend.
Well, to me, Gumshoe games don't have that much mechanical heft. They have just enough to kind of help you have a good time at the table investigating a mystery of some sort, you know? They don't really, most of the play is pretty much very fiction oriented in it, right? Because there's just not a lot of other stuff there to kind of cling on to. You have your skills, but I don't really view those as anything other than maybe some crutches when people are getting stuck on trying to like figure out a clue. That's about as story game-ish as I think I maybe have gotten. I'm trying to think of things that are even less mechanics or even more story forward that I played.
What about
with all of you, or maybe not?
What about Inspectors?
Right. That's what I was thinking of.
That's true. Inspectors had even less mechanics. There was a lot more player agency
The mechanics that were there were really narrative style. I don't know how to describe, I want to say narrative mechanics. Maybe that's not the right term, but you know, they were narrative devices more than mechanics in a way.
Or closer to what you'd see maybe in like an improv game and a theater group.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
I feel like there's, I want to come back to this. I want to put a pin in what I'm going to say right now, but I feel like there's so much overlap with the world of, so, you know, there's, I think of it as a continuum, and that's probably not. It's probably more of a matrix or something, but between, you know, crunchy games, story games, games like Gumshoe, which I think maybe are sort of in between those two, you know, full story and full crunch, and things like actual play. Right? Actual play podcasts or YouTube or Twitch or whatever.
So what are you thinking there? I'm super interested in that.
Well, I think actual play, I think about actual play so much, considering I don't watch it very much and I should watch it more to have a real opinion about it. It really fascinates me because it's driven RPG growth so much, but I also feel like it's not super representative of the historical RPG experience. And this is not a zero judgment here about any of this. This is just like this, things change, right? Things change.
Yeah.
Audiences change.
Yep.
And we want to embrace that, obviously. But I feel like it's kind of bifurcating a little bit into different modes of play. And actual play seems like a very new thing to me. You know, it's the idea, again, that we now have what used to be a purely, there were no observers in role-playing games. Everybody was a participant, and now we have observers.
That's right. I wonder if this is how people felt, like the wargamers felt when D&D made that turn into, you know, much more of a narrative driven, you know, experience than crunching through a dungeon, right?
Right.
I think for me, the thing about actual play is I think when we play role-playing games, we're playing it for our own enjoyment, and it is about our enjoyment and whatever that means, if that's overcoming challenge, if that's the challenge of creating a great story. Whereas with actual play, it is actually, I think certainly there are some people who just get online, play a game and record it. But if you talk about the ones that are like high production value, clearly intended to build an audience, it is so much more about the enjoyment of the audience rather than the enjoyment of the participants that it feels more like entertainment, which is great and good. I love what it's done for the industry.
Sure.
But it's more an ad for gaming than it is maybe gaming itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think of an analogous example of something like that where you had a game or something competitive or something where it was an at-home activity that broke out into an observed phenomenon. I can't think of any other analogous examples, but maybe something will come to me.
Yeah,
I
agree.
Go on. Yeah.
Oh, no, I was going to say, like, you could say there's probably a lot of examples in sports where games that were, I mean, you know, basketball used to be guys just throwing a ball into a literal basket. Right. And then at some point it becomes something you watch and it changes, right?
And it becomes a national conversation and like a pastime. But
if anything, it's actually more of an actual game when it's being watched because so many eyes are on it and so many people are so invested in the rules being followed. Although that happens with actual play too. People get upset when actual plays don't follow the rules sometimes.
But it is, I think you're right that in sports, it intensifies the gaminess because the stakes to win are so high that you're double invested in winning, whereas I think it is less true in actual play to think about, you know, do I care? Am I here because I want to have a great experience or because I want to be super creative in how I overcome my challenges? Or is it just about entertainment for somebody else? And like, if I'm bored because Matt Mercer's giving a 7-minute monologue, is that okay because the viewers are eating it up?
Gaming perspective.
Yes, exactly. Right. Very much so. No shade on Matt Mercer. He's amazing at what he does.
Sure. But what were you saying there, Jason? I'm sorry. I didn't mean
to. Well, I was going to say, oh, no, it's fine. I was just going to say that when you watch sports, the more you watch sports, the more you understand the mechanics of the sport, like the meta of it. Like you understand the underlying systems. The more you watch an actual play, you don't gain any additional real mastery of like the underlying RPG system that they're using. You're getting mastery of the fiction, right?
There are actual plays I've seen where I didn't know, even after having watched many episodes, what system they were using.
Right.
At all.
And maybe this gets to Eric's thing about fiction first gaming, right? I think if I sat down and watched an Inspector's table, like, you know, play, and afterwards you quizzed me and you were like, well, what were the rules of that game? I'd be like, I kind of don't know, right? Whereas I think I would guess that about Gumshoe. And I think that that's maybe part of some of the line that we're talking about here a little bit.
Like you feel like you would know what the rules of Gumshoe are a little bit.
I feel like after like a couple hours of watching, like, okay, there's a pool that they drain from and then they've got to roll under this thing. Cause you'd see the mechanical actions happening more often. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is actually,
I want to ask you a question, Eric. And you too, Jason, but in regards to your comment about deriving enjoyment from observers of actual play, deriving enjoyment from watching a kind of a narrative performance, right?
Yep.
And the key thing not being like, are the rules being followed and are we all complying with that, but more like, or even being applied, but, you know, is a satisfying narrative arc occurring? Do you feel like your play or your interest in role-playing games at home or in our group or whatever has shifted over time from a more kind of crunch, you know, we're applying a rule system here to more satisfying narrative arcs occur at the table?
I have a really hard time with this. I feel like definitely my play has changed and has changed in a way very similar to what you're talking about. But I don't know that I would say that it has moved from mechanics focused to narrative arc focused, because I will say out of a lot of playing and having a ton of fun, and I think this is true of all improv experiences, of which I kind of think role-playing games are one, is great narrative arcs just don't come out of troupe improv play. And but I would say that I have moved from great play being about what type of character you are, if that's a class or your ability set, to thinking about, okay, here's my character in this fictional position. What would be a really great, and great could mean clever, it could mean funny, it could mean, you know, gets us out of a situation really well. It could mean embodying my character's, you know, goals and desires, but that thinking about that great play as being, oh, this character is doing something very interesting rather than this player is making interesting mechanical choices. And that is definitely a move that I've been making in the games that I play, the games that I homebrew. I think so. I don't know. What do you think? What about you, Ethan?
I would say that for me, if I was to take it as an extreme example, if I was playing a game which was just like an improv troupe kind of game, right? Just creating a story in an improv manner with no crunch, no rules, no constraints. I feel like I would not play well because I would fall back on tropes, narrative tropes, that just because I'm reaching for things that are close by intellectually and kind of experientially from a narrative perspective. And not that those are bad, and there's so many interesting tropes in story, but I just feel like I won't get the best out of my experience that way. And combining narrative play with mechanics that constrain me is way more interesting, right? I need that constraint.
I agree with that. I definitely agree with that.
Because then I'm not always reaching for the simplest thing. I'm not always reaching for the easy trope. I'm like, okay, I'm screwed. My character is screwed. And what am I going to do here? You know, and like what? And then you start to become creative, right? Creativity always comes from constraint for me.
And Jason, how would you say that maybe your play style has changed with respect to mechanics and fiction over time?
I mean, I think I'll get at this by starting with part of what I enjoy playing a game where Eric Saltwell was running it. So, you know, for those of you who've never played a game with Eric,
we're all dying.
I mean, Eric rewards both clever mechanical play and clever narrative, like fiction play, in his games. Like, you set up tactically interesting situations where clever use of mechanics is going to get you through it, or clever use of fiction is going to get you through it. And I think that's part of what makes me really enjoy playing games with you, is that you kind of set up this sandbox where either kind of one of those fit. And I think for me, I would have really enjoyed solving your mechanical puzzles like 5 years ago. And I think now I'm more interested in solving your fiction puzzles. And kind of that's, I think, how I've changed as a player. As a DM, I've always been somebody who's just, you know, never been a great rules lawyer. And I've always wanted the moment that I think could happen if the mechanics went the way that I wanted. And I think this, and it's specifically the way I want it, right? Because I this goes back to, I think all three of us appreciate that sense of authorship from a DM. This is to Ethan's point about like improv play, right? And so when people are like, well, never fudge dice rolls, I'm like, that's probably largely still true for me. Like, the failure is super interesting. But boy, if there's like this thing where I'm like, if only this one thing goes this one way, I think this narrative is going to take off in a super interesting direction. Totally okay if that mechanic gets kind of fudged a bit, or we give here and there on it. Because ultimately what I want is I want that narrative arc to happen at the table. I know that's not how everybody plays. I think a lot of people really like that. You know, they're like, listen, even if that thing would have been more fun, if you played out the failure, you probably would get to a more interesting spot. They might be very well right. It's just not my style, right? And so I tend to be somebody who, I think over the years, as my ability to maintain the mechanics of dozens of game systems has just waned, I lean more on my players saying something interesting in a fiction move sense, to use kind of your earlier language. And then I kind of use the mechanics to kind of play that out, versus I think maybe before that would have been maybe more reversed. I would have been like, what's the mechanic you're using? Now describe how that mechanic played out in the world. I think that's really what's changed in my DM. I think now I'd be like, tell me your fictional, you know, motion, and then we'll figure out the mechanics that support it.
So, and that to me is very much like this concept of fiction first gaming, which I think coming out of Fate, coming out of Apocalypse World and its derivatives. So I pulled this from the Fate SRD, is when character action should start with the fiction and be described in terms of the fiction, and then afterwards are interpreted into mechanics. And I think kind of what you're saying?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. It's funny. That's a system that I feel like I own a bunch of things. I've never actually sat down and read them. Yep. But maybe they've like, through osmosis, have come to be in my dreams or whatever. Or they've just been so influential that it touches so many other systems at this point, right? So.
Yeah, you know, I want to bring something up real quick here, which I think we're going to talk about, especially in terms of like the different types of games that involve more player agency. I know that term, the word agency, is also a loaded term, but basically the issue being that in sort of a traditional game that becomes very narrative centric for me, I feel a lot of pressure as a game master to craft that narrative. And it's true, I feel like as I have matured as a game master, I reach into my bag of tools. One of those tools is, when do I call for a roll? When do I decide to set that aside and you know, use some other method to kind of progress the narrative? But I still feel a lot of pressure to craft that overall narrative experience. Like I really feel like I'm the author of...
That's right.
I do feel... It's exciting and it's fun. It's a lot of pressure. I almost feel like it's more pressure It is more pressure than running a dungeon crawl, right? It is, because you know, you can design the dungeon crawl, you design the map, you sit down in homeroom if you're like me when I was in junior high school, and you draw for hours and you get all that stuff ready ahead of time. But with a narrative experience for the players, like, it is on the fly.
Yeah. Now, so here's a question for the three of you really quick. Are the three of us totally out of fashion with this now? Because I feel like the direction of tabletop RPGs has moved so thoroughly in the realm of player agency, player co-creation, that the kind of authorship that we are talking about, that we enjoy, like, having at a table, I feel like that's almost like fuddy-duddy in a sense.
I think you're right. This is it. This is one of the big questions.
Yeah. And so I totally agree with that. I think that certainly if you look at, but I think the whole thread of indie RPGs as opposed to traditional RPGs has been about this. And I have a hard time with it, right? On the one hand, you want really tight play. You want to create little crucibles that create high tension and stress and then see what people do. On the other hand, you want people to define their own motivations and come up with their own challenges as much as they can. And I have a hard time with it, honestly. I think you're right, Jason. I think I would probably be considered an old fuddy-duddy in terms of...
I think so. And like, I think the whole, like, don't prepare plots advice is good. And I'll say, in a weird way, the three of us, even though we're authorial, we're not preparing a script. We're not like, and then this player's going to do this, and this player's going to do this. I don't think that's what's happening, right? I think though we're saying thematically, here are the beats that we're going to probably hit during this session. I don't know exactly the path we're going to take to get there, right? But I've thought through those beats, and I've thought through some specific moments that, boy, I hope they get into a situation where that moment happens. But I don't think we're in the class of people, maybe I'm wrong, that the don't prepare plots advice is meant for necessarily.
Yeah, no, I definitely prepare plot and narrative beats that I want to see happen. Or, like, you know, in my case, I'll prepare, you know, 300% of the total expected volume of, you know, material, and people will play through, you know, 60% of it, right?
But you enjoyed that prep.
Yes, I did.
And I think that's one of the things that we talked about in the first episode, is like things that GMs just enjoy.
Yeah.
Like, part of this hobby is, like, we enjoy doing a lot of the prep stuff, you know, that's part of, like, what the hobby means to us, you know?
So it is also, it's lonely play for sure. It's that enjoyment, but it's also, it enriches the narrative. The 300% prep enriches the 50% that gets experienced at the table.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because you're able to, it's world building, right? And I feel like world building always pays off. And, you know, maybe, so in a way I could say, like, you know, this is, we're talking about kind of narrative world building as much as narrative creation and plot creation. But let me just step back for a second, because Eric, I had other questions for you. When you say fiction first, do you correlate that with, like, the term or phrase fiction forward?
Yes, I do. I think that those are synonymous.
I just want to make sure that I'm interpreting those as synonyms.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's talk about some more of this fictional position and things like that.
So I have a question for you guys, and actually, let me target this as Ed Jason, just given his response. But I'm super interested in your thoughts as well, Ethan. Jason, given how you talked about the role of the fiction there, and how that's really how you've been evolving and thinking about the game. So for you, what is the value of the rules, or, like, is it just getting to the point for you that rules are overhead? And if not, what's the value that they add?
So I think I would struggle to play a game without rolling dice. That just might be a silly mental block on my part, but, like, part of the experience for me is there's a bunch of funny looking dice on the table, and we're going to roll it, and something is going to happen because of those dice that I wasn't expecting, right? And to me, the mechanics are about, you know, creating moments of uncertainty and changing, you know, everything I prepped and everything the players were expecting, right? I think without that, this is why, like, I've never played Fiasco, for example. I think I went and bought it and I'm like, oh, I've heard so many good things about this. And then when I started kind of reading and kind of getting into it, I was just like, there's just not enough. There's not enough mechanical heft there for me to feel like it's a game for me. And so what I think, you know, I enjoy mechanics because they offer myself and players ways to create, to add chance essentially to the table and to move the fiction in different directions than we were expecting. And I think that's why I like it. I will say that also I'm surprised at how often great mechanical systems increase our ability to live the feel living in the fiction, right? Blades in the Dark, I think, does this great job of this with the clocks. And I feel like the clocks are both kind of metaphorically and just kind of the way they're mechanically used. They're these tension creators, and you're just creating these kind of multiple spinning flywheels of things that are happening. And that makes me feel like I'm in a heist movie. That makes me feel like the heat is coming and I got to get out the door, or I'm setting a plot that's going to, you know, kick off later. And so I like the mechanics because I think they help create the fiction. And I like mechanics because I think they create chance at the table that helps us create kind of more rich fiction. So I think that was a long answer, but no, you know.
Can I pop in there, Eric? Do you mind if I do a quick response to that, which is, you know, just to defend my baby gumshoe, I don't know how I feel about gumshoe. Like I love it, but I'm not sure I love it because of anything inherent or innate in it. Maybe what I love is the fact that there's some cool stories wrapped around it.
That's the thing is reading gumshoe is amazing, right? Yeah.
But the one thing Gumshoe does have that it sort of tries to implement mechanically is the idea of simulating a competent detective, I guess, right? Or detective with some competence, or an investigator with some competence. And that's always a tricky thing to do. And this is where I will mention and then back away from the concept of diegesis, but like diegetic music in a movie, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have diegetic and non-diegetic music that the characters hear in C2 in the scene, or music that is just the score, right? And diegetic, for me, there's diegetic mystery solving and there's non-diegetic mystery solving. There's, you know, you can solve a mystery with your actual meaty human brain sitting at the table, or your character can sort of magically solve the problem because they have the right skills.
Right. They made the right die roll or whatever.
Yeah. Or they had points in their pool. Which actually, this is sort of a good opportunity to transition to the concept of metacurrencies, I think.
Yep.
Right. But Eric, maybe you had some thoughts also on the clocks or what you wanted to talk about, because these are big moving parts in fiction.
Yeah, no, totally. And I love it. I think this is all great. I will say I have had some real trouble with clocks. Like, I agree with Jason.
Can you summarize clocks for people that haven't experienced
Blades? So a clock is effectively the hit pointization of every challenge you could ever do. So if you're trying to sneak into the mayor's house, then you might have a clock that represents how far into the building you've gotten. And you might have a clock that also represents how close are you to tripping the alarm and setting off like the guards chasing after you. In Gumshoe, Heat is actually kind of a clock, right? That's Knights Black Agents specifically, where the more crazy stuff you do and the more you are out in the public, the more your heat grows, and therefore the more you are at risk of being made aware. But clocks are, you could also imagine a clock that was trying to convince somebody to let you into a place you're not supposed to be, and you make arguments and die rolls. And like Jason, I love the fact that you can take a challenge and zoom in and, you know, have it not just be a single success failure. I love that it creates the tension that Jason just talked about. But I think there's a problem too. Inspectors has a clock. It's called job dice, right? Where every time you make a roll, if you succeed, your successful dice are added to the job dice, or can be. And if you get to X number of job dice that's defined at the beginning of the adventure, then you succeed. And I have not played a ton of inspectors, but in both games that I played, when we hit the job dice, the fiction didn't match the clock, right? Which is like, you're investigating and you're adding some clues, but you're maybe adding dice at a much quicker rate than you are really getting to the bottom of it and having that, I think, Ethan, you would say that non-diegetic experience of the meat minds that we all play with figuring it out.
Yeah.
And this, to me, it's almost like it's taking what could be a very fiction-forward thing and mechanicizing it. And I love the idea of clocks, and I keep trying to make it work, but I keep hitting this specific problem. And I think generally, this is actually also my challenge with story games more broadly, is, you know, if you think of this like in a Jason's aspect of fiction forward, you describe what you do, and then there's a resolution system that tells you what happens, and that's what provides that sense of bounce Jason was talking about. And my challenge is, I really want my ideal system for this is one where your chance of success is dependent on how great your play was, right? So did I do, in this fictional position, this attempt that my characters are doing from a fictional standpoint, from the fictional position, is it likely to succeed or unlikely? And then it tells me at the end, here's what happened and here's how the fiction changed. And this is like the loop we all play, and it's like the inner loop of role-playing games. Somebody describes a situation, somebody says what their action is, you come up with you roll some dice, and then there's a change to the fiction, rinse, lather, repeat. And story games, I feel like, and especially ones that are fixed difficulty, like Blades, for example, these are games where the resolution system doesn't take a lot of the fiction as input in, and that's because these games want such light mechanics. They only want what Jason wants. They just want a form of bounce, right? Whereas I think what I want out of it is reward players, define your resolution system should define great play for you. And it does that by rewarding with higher chances of success things that are better, more creative, things that are more likely to succeed. It says here is great fictional play, and my resolution system should take that into effect and then output it. And both clocks coming out on the output side feel like, you know, I did this action and it was a success, but rather than the fiction actually changing, the thing that really matters is how many job dice were added.
Right. Right. The mechanical change. Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And on the input side, I might have all the freedom to talk about, here's what my character does, and I'm doing a bunch of role playing, and maybe I did something really, really clever. But in a fixed difficulty system, I'm still just, I don't know, rolling 3d6 and hope that I get a 4 or above.
Right.
And so all that great play that I did, in a way, to me, feels wasted because that resolution system is not really doing its job.
Hmm.
So we, Eric, for the past couple of weeks, we've played a couple one-shots using the 2d20 system. We did the Dune role-playing game, and we did the Star Trek role-playing game. And in both of those, you get a big mechanical boost, like a big kind of reward boost, by essentially picking some options on your character sheet that, yeah, they match like the task at hand, but what they're really doing is they're showcasing what's different about your character. My character is really brave, and I picked the brave thing, which means I get a bonus here, right? How do you square kind of what you just talked about, which, you know, achieving kind of like that additional reward through play with that one's a very mechanical kind of reward through play. Like, I think that system kind of actually rewards looking at the character sheet and seeing which mechanics are going to benefit more than, here's a fictional, an interesting fictional thing. And then because of some mechanical thing that happens, I got an additional kind of reward or benefit at the end. How do you think about the interplay between that?
So I think, so this is the Mephidius.
Yeah, the 2D20 systems.
D20 system. And yeah. Here's what I think is really interesting. It has two components. So when you go to make a roll, and you say, "Oh, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to seduce the barmaid," and then you say, you look at your character sheet and you say, "Well, what is this? Is seducing? Is it covered by my command skill, or is it covered by my rapscallion skill? I don't know, making something up, right?" And I'm not, like, I understand that, that an attempt there is being made there to make it fiction first. I think people who, at least myself, I am system mechanically enough inclined that I always do that translation in my head, right? Like, oh, if I take this type of action, I know I can put it under this category.
Right.
And, but then you do go to the resolution mechanism where there's two things. One, usually there's some opposed force that rolls a set of D20s, and how many successes, you know, and you have to kind of beat that number of successes.
Right.
And again, this feels more like, it's not fixed, it's variable, there's more bounce, but it's not, I would really honestly mostly prefer that a DM in a rulings over rules way is saying, oh, well, you met this barmaid 3 seconds ago. The chances you're going to get her into your bed in the next 7 minutes is really, really low. Like, that's a very difficult thing to do. And I would rather use that to define the likelihood of succeeding over, oh, well, here's a resolution mechanism system. And it doesn't really, it doesn't take very much of the fictional position into account. Does that make sense, Jason?
It does. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Because, like, one of them is we're going to play Yahtzee against each other.
Right.
And the other one is we're going to use kind of the fictional setting, right, to create the mechanic, the challenge, the mechanical challenge, right? So,
Yeah, I mean, I can also see, like, it's okay to get to the Yahtzee point, but the fiction has to be able to veto it. This is also, I mean, you know, one you can play in a computer RPG, right?
Yeah.
And the other one, which to me is the higher level of play, puts that primacy on the fiction, you have to do with humans at the table.
That's right.
So I say in the year 2023, for our future AI overlords, we welcome you at our table.
So for you, Ethan, what is the value for you of having those rules?
The mechanical rules?
Yeah.
You know, I when you were talking about this stuff, I was really thinking about Gumshoe again, because one of the things that I love and dislike about Gumshoe simultaneously, you have a lot of skills, and those skills, you know, invariably at the table, it'll be something like I remember when I was running Yellow King in Paris.
Yep.
At one point, everybody was in this office. It was an office space that you'd broken into. You know, you just sort of are like, well, who has, I don't know, sneak or search or, you know, library science or whatever it is.
Yep.
You know, library science. Well, you notice that this book is misshelved. You know, whatever it is, you're just kind of looking for a good narrative fit. And it almost feels like shopping. The way around that for me, so that it doesn't feel like shopping, is that I try to keep lists of, you know, I literal spreadsheet of like who has what skill, and I try to craft the narrative such that I can be more directed and intentional about saying like, you have library science, you know, not so
that's
it's,
right.
It's, yeah. And that it's such a minor point, but the difference between sort of like, you know, shopping for a skill at the table and intentionally spotlighting somebody is a huge narrative change for me.
And it helps them remind themselves of what their character is about.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, we shouldn't like assume that players from session to session remember all the different skills that their character has.
Sure.
There's
not
a lot of times you have like an idea in your head during character creation. If it doesn't show up in the first three sessions, you're like, oh yeah, I forgot. I always have a dagger in my boot, right?
<That's> you know, right. So, which leg limps? I have a limp? What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, again, this puts a lot of pressure on the game master.
So let's go back to Blades in the Dark for a second, because there are two rules that I think really highlight to me what is very, very strongly fiction first, but then also what is the rule that in almost all of RPGs, I think, is the least fiction first. So in Blades in the Dark, when you make a roll, right, your ability sheet tells you how many dice to roll, but then the GM declares this is the your position and your impact for the roll, which is entirely fictional driven. And so, and position is really how much danger you're in, how much risk is there in the roll, and impact if you fail, and impact is if you succeed, how much progress are you going to make on filling in a clock or defeating your enemy or achieving your goal. And I love this. I feel like it really, it's a systematic way of taking in the inputs. In the related game, Band of Blades, there's a character who has a special ability that is, oh, rather than a shield, you have a tower shield. And I was very confused by this rule because I looked all through the rest of the rule book looking for what does that matter? Why is that important? Like, I did a PDF search, tower is only found once in the whole game. I'm not sure that that's true, but spiritually, it's correct. And I went on the forums and I was like, hey, am I misunderstanding this rule a little bit? And they were like, no, that's just a different fiction. And your DM may rule that either, oh, your position is lessened because you have a tower shield, not just a regular shield. Or, oh, maybe if you want to hide behind it from arrows, you can't do that with a buckler, but you sure could do that with a tower shield. And this to me is such a great resolution system. I know that it can drag down for a lot of people. But I love that how much it takes in inputs of the current fictional position. From a low perspective is resistance rolls. So this is probably the thing that people is one of the things that Blades is most famous for is that if the players don't like the effect of a roll and they want to negate it, they can roll. They just say, I negate it. And they have a emotional hit points called stress, and they roll to see how much stress it causes them to negate it. And this rule drives me bonkers crazy because like, even like I know John Harper who's, I mean, like, I don't know him, but I've heard him say, oh, you know, failure can be fun, but this is a rule which literally is just a veto over the fictional result, over the bounce Jason talked about, right? Over the result of your actions, you can just say no. And it just is like mechanics running roughshod, having its way over the fiction.
I wanted to get a definition for a fictional position from the first moment I heard you say it. And we've gone this whole episode without really defining it. But is would you say, so, you know, you have your character sheet, you have your stats on your character sheet. That's like a skeleton of your character. But would you say the fictional position is the... it's the non-statistics, but the elements of your character, which are non-statistical, but narrative related. What is define fictional position more precisely?
So for me, so for me, it is the current situation in which the character finds themselves and the actions they are attempting to take. So,
You mean it's environmental almost. It's external to the character.
It is. And then like, and then you decide how you act in that fictional position. So in Runehammer, Index Card RPG. In Index Card RPG, there is a rule that says, hey, when that they don't do difficulty class by, like a DC, they don't have a difficulty for an action. Instead, they just define a difficulty for a whole encounter, right? So you might say, oh, this encounter is a DC 17. That's what you have to hit every time you roll. Now,
that's cool. That's interesting.
Yep.
Yeah.
But the thing is, that is a description of the situation that is entirely mechanical, non-fictional, right?
It's like the action die in 13th Age, right?
Yes, exactly.
Or escalation. I'm sorry, not action.
The escalation die. Yep. That's right. And so it is just the situation you find yourself in. And so, It may be that your Knights Black Agents characters round a corner and there's people who are ready to attack them, right? And that is a very dangerous situation. But maybe they're underground in a tunnel and the character says, oh, I'm going to shoot the light out, and it just goes pitch black. And that's how they defend themselves. And to me, that is interacting with the fictional position. And it's not a description of the mechanical situation.
Well, I totally misread that interpretation of fictional position. This whole time I've been thinking more about fictional position as the almost, I would maybe propose a different term then, which would be fictional stance.
Sure.
right? Which would be the internalized kind of narrative arc or narrative experience of the character.
That's right. Right. Yeah. So that's like the, is that for you then is the, I shoot out the light bulbs?
No, that would be more, if your character was afraid of the dark.
Yes. Okay. I hear what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. Then it's part of a fictional stance.
I got it. Right. Or if you're, this is like Drives in a way almost. I know this is a mechanicization of it, sure. But it's kind of like Drives in Gumshoe where,
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I think you could include that as part of the entire fictional position, includes your character's fictional stance.
Right. Wow, this has been great.
Yeah.
I feel like we cleared it all up and answered all questions. This will be part one in a series of 100, obviously, regarding fiction and RPGs.
Just like we did the last two episodes, let's go around and talk about something that we talked about today that you're going to take away and try to take into your game.
I think for me, it's going to cause me to re-examine a little bit more deeply just my own style. Like, because one of the things that today's conversation kind of opened up for me is I don't think I'm as convicted about some of the beliefs that I think I like at the beginning, if you were to have pulled me on some things, I think I'm less sure on the other side of this on kind of how convicted I am on the interplay between narrative and the fiction in the world that I would have said I was at the beginning. And so I think the thing I'm going to take to my table. So I'm just going to kind of watch myself a little bit over the next couple sessions and see like, where do I enjoy, play the most and like maybe think about my beliefs there a little bit more.
Prep aspect of things a little bit. So much of my RPG play is really just inherited, accreted over time. And, it's like Star Trek, the motion picture. You strip it all away and you find Voyager. you strip it all away. You find inside me, you find Moldvay Basic, the pink box, And I just feel like I need to kind of like excavate those layers a little bit and see if I can lay some new foundations. Not that I don't have great love for Moldvay Basic, but lay some new foundation and recast. I feel like I can be intentional. I love crunch. I love mechanics. I love rules. But now this conversation has made me rethink the purpose of all of that. Yeah, this has been a great conversation. I think this is, I'm not sure what the impact is going to be. I just want to stop and rethink things and reread Blades. So.
So for me very specifically, I think I'll just have some recency effect here, obviously, but I feel like I think a lot about those external parts of the fictional position and like, I think of my job as a DM or GM as crafting really messed up fictional positions or situations, let's say that, situations in which I put characters, but I am only thinking about those external fictional positions, and I need to be thinking more about that, what you called the fictional stance, and how do I incorporate more of those internal pieces of the fiction for the characters, because I think I do a way less good job at that, so thank you for that. Well, that's it for this episode of RPG X-Ray. On this episode, we touched a lot of what we're sure will be recurring themes on this show, including fiction versus mechanics in RPGs, the various implementations of fiction-forward systems in games, how to apply these no matter what games you might be playing, and some of the tensions between fiction and crunch.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us improve the show and reach more listeners who share our passion for role-playing games.
As always, we hope this episode has given you some new insights and ideas for your own table. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us on our website or social media channels available in the show notes and at rpgxray.com.